case and only case 99-0327, 99-0858, Minnesota Fire and Casualty Company versus Paper Recycling of La Crosse, and Joyce A. Devonport versus Paper Recycling Company. Now, my sheet shows that Attorney Curtis will argue for 25 minutes on paper recycling, representing paper recycling. Dean Rohde will argue 15 minutes for Joyce A. Devonport. John Cook will argue for Minnesota Fire and Casualty Insurance Company for 15 minutes. And Mr. Curtis, you have 5 minutes rebuttal. Is that your understanding? Okay. Mr. Curtis.
May it please the court, my name is James Curtis of the firm of Hale Skemp Hansen Skemp and Slyke in La Crosse, representing Petitioner Paper Recycling of La Crosse, Inc. and its insurer, General Casualty Company. This case comes before the court on review of a divided decision by the Court of Appeals. After consolidating the two litigation cases in question, the Court of Appeals reviewed the contrary decisions of the two circuit court judges from La Crosse County, one of whom found that recreational immunity would apply in favor of paper recycling, and the other which denied our motion for summary judgment. In a decision authored by Judge Ike and joined in by Judge Bergeron, the Court of Appeals concluded that the boys in question were not engaged in a recreational activity at the time of the incident and that immunity would not apply. Judge Charles Dykeman dissented on the ground that the boys' objective conduct and their subjective purpose met the definition of recreational activity intended by the legislature when it enacted Section 895.52. Paper recycling's position on this appeal is entirely consistent with the rationale expressed by Judge Dykeman in his dissent. The specific issue before this court is whether the boys were engaged in recreational activity on the premises of paper recycling on May 28, 1997. The material facts on the summary judgment motions are not in dispute. All parties agree that the boys were engaged in outdoor play activities after school and went onto the premises of paper recycling to play among bales of paper that were stored in an outside yard. The boys themselves characterized their activity as playing among tunnels within the bales of paper, which led to rooms or ports in the paper bales where they played their games. And it's undisputed that on the day in question, one of the boys brought along some matches that all three participated in lighting of matches, and the fire that ensued destroyed my client's business premises and tragically resulted in the death of Ms. Devonport's 11-year-old son. The recreational immunity statute is the crux of this case. The current version of the statute dates to 1983, when the legislature made a comprehensive revision of the former statute, which was sometimes known as the berry-picking statute. The current statute and the cases interpreting it make a number of things clear which are important to the present case. First, as a lessee and occupier of the premises, paper recycling clearly qualifies as an owner under the statutory definition for immunity purposes. In addition, it's clear that the application of the statute is not limited by the nature of the property involved. Whether the property is within city limits or in a rural or agricultural area, whether it's vacant or otherwise developed or improved, industrial or residential, the immunity will apply so long as the property user was engaged in recreation at the time of the incident.
So what you're telling this court is that we have to focus on the nature of the boys' activities rather than on the nature of the property. The property involved is a commercial property with a fence around it.
Right.
Now, does it make any difference in this case whether these boys were trespassers? Would it make any difference in this case?
I don't believe it would, Justice, because under this court's decision in Bertelsjack, the court took the opportunity
to... That was the Mosinee paper case, right?
That's correct. And the court, while that case didn't involve trespassing...
Isn't there a difference in the property there? As I recall, Mosinee, this was a outdoor, big forest-type property with a road going through it. And here we're talking about, I suppose, a commercial activity within a community or a city with a fence around it, assumingly saying, keep out, don't come in here. Could be this kind of certainly characterized this almost as an attractive nuisance in the sense that boys of that age would like to play and, you know, build forts and things of that nature.
Justice, I think that under the terms of the statute, the legislature did not try to limit the nature of the property to which the immunity could apply. And as this court clarified in Bertlejack, it doesn't matter whether the property user be a trespasser or an invitee on the premises.
But does it make sense? I mean, just thinking from a rural property to something, I don't know, you could say that this building could be characterized as allowing, quote, recreational immunity if someone comes in and recreates here. Is that, that's where you're just saying that the key here is that it's on the nature of the boy's activity or the trespasser's activity.
That is the primary focus, Justice. It only applies to outdoor activities, number one, so that an interior building would have no application.
Let's say on the outside of the building.
Okay. But yes, I think that under the Linville test, the court will look to all aspects of the activity, including its nature and purpose and consequence, as well as the property user's intent. I think it's an appropriate consideration in a given case for a court to consider the nature of the property in the context of all of the facts and circumstances. But the court has made clear in Linville, in Bertlejack, and in the Siebert case, I think, that the focus is on the nature of the property user's activity, with the nature of the property being, in most cases, a secondary consideration. And what we get to then is that if the property user is engaged in recreation, regardless of the type of property that's involved, the owner of the property under sub 2B of the statute is immune from liability. And sub 2A of the statute makes clear that in those circumstances, the owner has no duty to keep the property safe for the activity or to give warning of an unsafe condition, use, or activity on the property.
Am I correct that these boys had been on the premises previously?
The record supports that, yes, sir.
And apparently had engaged previously in similar activity, at least as far as the playing that was going on?
That's correct.
I view this case as providing some tension, if you will, between attractive nuisance on one side and recreational activity and recreational immunity on the other side. How should we balance that tension? How should we
I think that, again, we go back to 1983 when the legislature adopted the current version of the statute. And at that time, the legislature specifically considered how the grant of immunity would affect rights under both the Safe Place Statute in Wisconsin and the attractive nuisance theory. Subsection 7 of the statute specifies that the immunity overcomes any claim of liability under safe place law or attractive nuisance doctrine. And I think that for purposes of analysis, this court has to understand that the legislature in 1983 knew the law of attractive nuisance and knew that legal theory, required a showing that a property owner knew or should have known of a dangerous condition on the premises, that children were likely to trespass upon the premises, and that the children, because of their young age and immaturity, would not likely appreciate the danger or the risk of harm from the property condition. With knowledge of those elements of the theory, the legislature made the conscious choice to say that the recreational immunity would overcome, if you will, the attractive nuisance theory. And so we submit that this court should give effect to the legislature's choice and purpose in enacting that law. Judge Eichmann's dissent points up some of the legislative history that led up to the statute in 1983, and certainly there was a direct purpose and a clear statement in sub 7 of the statute that the attractive nuisance doctrine would be trumped, if you will. by the immunity. Now, this does not mean that the attractive nuisance theory has been totally abrogated. The immunity only applies if children are engaged in recreation. It doesn't apply if the property owner is guilty of some malicious conduct, which is accepted from the statute. It only applies to outdoor activities. But there's no question that this statute impairs the vitality of the attractive nuisance law.
Well, do you think whenever there's a situation where children are playing that automatically they're within recreational activity?
I do not.
That overrides attractive nuisance?
I don't think it's that simple, Justice Wilcox. I think that the court would be guided by the elements of the Linville test, and that each case is fact-intensive in looking at all of the circumstances, the nature of the activity, the consequence of the activity, and the subjective intent and purpose as a relevant factor. And if looking at a given case, that adds up to an activity that either meets the exact definition in the statute of recreational activity or is viewed as something that is substantially similar to what the legislature had in mind, then yes, recreation is involved.
Counsel, are you finished with your answer?
Yes, thank you.
Counsel, what do you do when the, just picking up on your last words, that the definition of recreational activity is met, that is the first sentence of the statute, but that it's not consistent with the 28 examples. Let me give you an hypothetical, and it's not hypothetical, it's reality. When I drop my high school kids off in the morning, on one of the corners about a block from the high school, there are a group of kids that meet every morning, about 7-8 kids, by and large to smoke and to talk. Now, when I think of that activity, it's outside, and I think it probably accurate to say they do that for relaxation or pleasure, which is part of the definition of recreational activity. Outdoor activity done for recreation or pleasure. Yet that type of activity seems inconsistent with the list of 28. How do you reconcile that inconsistency? It falls under the clear definition of recreational activity, but is not consistent with the examples.
I think, Justice Bradley, that that involved primarily the court's decision in the Siebert case as to how this definition is going to be viewed. And I would just mention that I found the later Lasky decision, Judge Bergeron analyzed Justice Abramson's decision in Siebert, which I think gives the proper approach for the definition. In Siebert, the activity certainly involved some element of exercise, relaxation, or pleasure, but it didn't meet the 28 specifically listed elements, and it didn't meet the third prong of the definition, any other outdoor sport, game, or educational activity. So with only the first broad definition being met, the court then looked to whether the activity in question was substantially similar to what the legislature had in mind in adopting this statute, bearing in mind, I think, the statement of legislative intent that accompanied the statute requiring a broad and liberal interpretation. So that in your factual example, while the children may be involved in some measure of relaxation or pleasure while smoking, it's not an outdoor sport or game, and I don't think it's within the confines of what the legislature had in mind. In the present case...
Well, in some ways, that seems problematic to me, because what you have is the definition, which includes my smoking situation. Then you have the next part of the statute is listing 28 factors. One is at odds of the other. And then you say, and then you have a third definition. Then you say, well, what you do is go to the legislative intent. But the legislative intent, as set forth in the 1983 Act, just says the same thing. I mean, it says that there's some broad language, and then it says, but while it's not possible to specify in every statute every activity, this Act provides examples of the 28 things. I mean, so that just kind of reiterates the legislative intent, reiterates what you can see on the face of the statute.
But doesn't it go on to say that where substantially similar circumstances exist, the legislature intends the law to be liberally construed in favor of immunity and in favor of property owners? So I think that...
Are you saying that second part of the statute, the examples, is more controlling than the definition in the first sentence?
No. I think that the broad definition under the Siebert case is modified by what comes after. So that there are many situations where the broad definition may be met, but the activity isn't what the legislature had broadly in mind in defining the term. I think, Justice, that the proper approach for this case is that the boys were involved in a measure of exercise, relaxation, pleasure after school, that their activity in playing among the tunnels and forts of the bales of paper qualifies as an outdoor sport or game under the third prong of the definition. And at that point, it almost becomes unimportant to compare the activity to the 28 specific listed items. I mean, we can talk about the similarities there, but I think that when the first and third prongs of the definition are met, that we have a recreational activity both on an objective basis as to the facts of record that we see with these boys playing outdoor games, and completely consistent with that, the subjective level of their showing of a purpose to engage in outdoor games after school. Obviously, an innocent and harmless activity, which is something that the legislature would have no trouble with until it rises to a level of danger with the involvement of matches in this particular case. The Court of Appeals appears to have been concerned with the intent element of this Linville test. It seemed to acknowledge that the boy's stated purpose was to enter the premises for the purpose of playing among the tunnels and forts, but the Court of Appeals felt that Judge Mulroy, in granting immunity at the trial court level, had placed undue emphasis on the boy's stated intent. But I think the Linville case puts the intent element of the test in context. Linville is a case where the plaintiff was a guest passenger in a van, had her young son along. The host driver of the van wanted to take them down to the city fishing pond to look for a fishing spot for the next day. The record showed that the plaintiff was adamantly opposed to this. She argued with the host driver. She demanded to be taken home, but he refused and was in control and went down to the pond. They shined the lights in the pond water. The truck became stuck in the muck. The plaintiff got out in kind of a frantic attitude to rectify the situation when the van lurched forward into the pond with her young son inside, and both occupants of the vehicle drowned. Now, the Court of Appeals there held that there could be no recreation because the plaintiff was adamantly opposed to participating in the activity. And this court reversed the Court of Appeals and held that the underlying or generic nature of the activity was recreational, and that while intent is an appropriate consideration under the Linville test, intent is not dispositive. So that the context of Linville is that a plaintiff cannot defend against recreational immunity by denying an intent to recreate. To this extent, intent is not dispositive. But in our view, the court must consider both the objective facts bearing on the activity and the subjective purpose and intent. And if the property user intended to recreate and play games, and if the objective facts are consistent with that intent, then the activity as here is recreational as any other outdoor sport or game or activity that is similar to those listed in the statute. Really, in this case, the facts are quite simple. We have young boys who are playing outdoor games. They trespassed onto the premises of paper recycling in order to play among these imaginary tunnels and forts in the bales of paper. And in our view, the fact that the boys chose to play their games at a commercial recycling business is unusual, but does not change the objective nature and purpose of their activity. There was an element of relaxation or pleasure involved under the first prong of the definition, and we feel that the third prong of any other outdoor sport or game, in light of the legislature's purpose in adopting the law in 1983, shows that we are dealing here with an activity that is recreational.
Counsel.
Just to play devil's advocate with you, because I don't particularly espouse this, but there is the problem that keeps coming up in my mind is this is commercial property. It's not recreational property. And so I guess one way of asking it is, couldn't we construe this statute to say that the legislature intended to exempt recreational activity that occurred on recreational property, or property that is normally used for recreational activity? How would you respond to that?
Well, the statute does not allow for that, in our view. The statute does not restrict its application to any particular type of property. And I think that for this court to try to make that sort of a distinction would get dangerously close to perhaps rewriting the statute and taking it a direction that the legislature did not intend. There's a lot of examples that we could look at where the statute would clearly apply to a commercial property. Let's take a shopping center where the owner in the wintertime plows snow from the parking lots and it's deposited in an area off the beaten track. And young boys see the snow pile and decide to build some forts, and they do some tunneling, and one of the tunnels collapses and an injury occurs.
So there's not a fence around that property.
Well, that's true. That's true. There's not a fence around that property, Justice Babich. But again,
And I presume the fence is designed to keep people out, not to keep people in.
Again, I go back to what this court said in the Bertelsjack case. You know, a property owner in Wisconsin can post his or her land and try as best as possible to keep people out. But if a trespasser comes onto that land and engages in recreation and an injury occurs, the immunity clearly applies. I think that that's what this court has made very clear. So that is applied to the present case. While we did not, Paper Recycling did not want children on these premises, unfortunately they got in and they played their games and we know what happened. The fact that it is a commercial property certainly is a proper consideration for the court in the context of all of the facts and circumstances. We feel, however, that in looking at all of the facts and circumstances, we have objective factual evidence of playing outdoor games. We have a subjective stated purpose of wanting to play outdoor games after school. We have the boys involving with these tunnels and forts that an 11-year-old's imagination will take them to. And we have the fact that this happened at a commercial site. Given all of those circumstances, we feel that the weight to be given to the fact that it's a commercial property is very small, and that looking and focusing on the nature of the activity, it is recreational.
If I was a mother and taking my kids to visit their dad in prison in Columbia, so we're on prison land, and the kids are fooling around as we're walking into the prison, do you think that's the kind of property that the legislature intended be considered recreational property and immune from liability, owners immune from liability?
I think that kids fooling around is not recreational, or not necessarily recreational.
Well, it's not recreational for the mother, but it's recreational for the kids.
Okay, but it's recreational in that sense, in the first prong of the definition. I think maybe we need...
When I say fooling around, okay, they have a ball and they're throwing it back to one another. I mean, that gets me into it.
Okay.
Or let's say they do the same thing on... in a in a foundry yard, which may not be all that different than what we have here. Do you think the legislature, in its wild imagination, was trying in its intent to encourage the owners to open up this property for recreation?
Not necessarily. What the legislature had in mind was to broadly encourage Wisconsin owners to open up their land. And in order to accomplish that, what the legislature sought was to have a broad and a possible bright line test that would then encourage people and avoid judicial constructions that would make inroads, that would provide for what the court in the Vertlejack case said was the, quote, certainty that a true immunity statute would apply. If under the Taylor versus City of Appleton case involving catch with a football in a city park, it was deemed to be recreational. If these boys in the present case had been playing catch with a football in the yard of paper recycling in La Crosse, that is a recreational activity. And immunity would apply in that case, even though it is a commercial site, even though it is not otherwise open for recreation, and even though it's a locale that the legislature probably wouldn't want to be opened up for recreation. The legislature's purpose here is to make a broad encouragement to property owners. And the only way to do that is to have a broad and liberal interpretation of the statute.
Hasn't the legislature recycled their law a little bit? They no longer talk about encouraging people to open up their property, but to provide that's my recollection anyway of the history of the law. That used to be the statement.
I think the distinction, Justice, and my time is up, but if I may respond to your question.
May.
I think that the distinction is that prior to 1983, and looking at the history of the statute, in earlier days there was a requirement that the owner hold the land open for use by the public in order for the immunity to apply. That was abrogated, if you will, in 1983, so that there is no longer a requirement that the land be held open in order for immunity to apply. But there is no category of particular property to which the statute applies. It is a general and remains a general encouragement, as recognized again in the Vertlejack case, that the statutory purpose is to encourage people to open their land and make it available for public use.
Those words still appear in the statute?
They do not. I don't believe they appear in the statute. I think they appear in a number of cases of this court and the Court of Appeals interpreting the statute.
One other question. Counsel, I presume you know all of these past cases better than I do. I can't remember them all. Are any of our past cases in which we found recreational immunity, did the activity occur on anything other than property that on which recreational activity is normally employed?
I don't believe so. I believe, Justice, that
this would be the first commercial property.
I think this would be the first commercial case, with the exception of a recent Court of Appeals decision in Bethke versus Lauderdale of La Crosse. It's at 235 Wisconsin 2nd 103. That case involves a condominium complex where a unit owner, to make a long story short, was traveling down to his boat dock when he was injured and sued the association which ran the condominium. That is not in the context of a recreational setting or even an open setting. It's a closed setting. And so I think that is some guidance for the court that the immunity can apply to a commercial enterprise.
I thought we had a case that involved a land that was being used for cutting trees or timber, and that somebody was recreating. That was Mosinee.
I think that's Mosinee in part. Justice, I don't think there was commercial activity at the time of the accident, but
no,
it was in part.
Commercial property. Okay, counsel, thank you.
Thank you.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Rohde.
Thank you. Honorable Justices, my name is Dean Rohde. I represent Joyce A. Devenport individually and as personal representative of the estate of Daniel Raymond Devenport, deceased. I am with Biagoff and Rohde in River Falls, Wisconsin. Honorable Justices, this court has an opportunity to determine what activities should be encouraged and what activities should be discouraged on the part of landowners and also on the part of land users. Although Mr. Curtis characterizes a portion of the facts in this case as these children being involved in outdoor play activities where the boys went to play among paper bales in tunnels, and that one of the boys brought matches, Ronald Murray, not Daniel Devenport, and that a fire lit by Murray ensued. The additional facts are that Daniel Devenport, after helping the other two boys through a hole in the paper tunnels, was trapped because he was too large to fit through, and he died. The affidavit of fact in this case by Andrew Barney indicates that for 5 minutes before the fire, Daniel Devenport was sitting in a corner doing basically nothing. We need to look at the facts in the entire context of what occurred on this day. Because as we know from the Vertlejack case, the test to determine whether a person is engaged in a recreational activity is an objective one, not a subjective one. The court examines all aspects of the activity, including its intrinsic nature, purpose, and consequence. The injured party's subjective assessment is relevant, but it is not controlling. In 1995, this court decided the Siebert case, and it indicated that activities substantially similar to the 28 enumerated activities should also be regarded as recreational. As we look at the facts of this case, it is very difficult to conceive how the activities that these boys were engaged in on this day and on May 28th of 1997 were substantially similar to the activities that are listed, the 28 activities listed under the statute. The Court of Appeals held that Daniel Devenport and his companions were not engaged in a recreational activity because the boys' imaginary game playing in piles of baled papers in an industrial yard is not substantially similar to the activities listed in Section 895.52, paragraph 1G. The court also stated this case is more similar to Shannon versus Shannon, a 1989 Supreme Court decision where a three-year-old child's random wanderings did not constitute recreational activity. So how do we judge the nature of the activity? Under Siebert, the definition of recreational activity is broad. But there has to be a place where the line can be drawn, or there will be no line. In situations like this case, where we have a poorly fenced industrial property, may be encouraged rather than discouraged. Under Siebert, we have...
Is there a difference, counsel, between industrial and full commercial? Because in the Verdolia case, it's clear that that was commercial. You can have commercial farming. I can't imagine that that would be the distinguishing characteristic of the legislation. Would this be a, would industrial make a difference?
Your Honor, I
don't... I noticed you used industrial rather than commercial.
And that was a fortuitous use, I suppose. Okay. I did not intend to distinguish industrial from commercial. I think that they would probably be considered one and the same. One of the suggestions that I think should be looked at is when looking at the nature of the activity, which is critical in a case such as this, we sometimes can become too caught up in the subjective aspect of the facts. And particularly when we have a case that involves a child. In this case, we do, and I think that is very critical, just as we did in Shannon. What was the subjective intent of the 3-year-old child and its random wanderings in Shannon. The child probably intended to play. What is the subjective intent of the children in Devonport? And when would we have a situation where 3 children, ages 10 or 11 years of age, in an outdoor, unsupervised activity, given, such as in this case, potentially an attractive nuisance, when would the situation occur when they would not be intending to subjectively play?
But, Counsel, the statute specifically speaks to attractive nuisance and says that it's the intent of the legislature to override attractive nuisance.
Your Honor, I acknowledge that fact. I don't believe that there was an intention for a complete abrogation of attractive nuisance. I think that attractive nuisance can be a factor, but I absolutely acknowledge what you're saying with regard to the fact that attractive nuisance does not in any way, shape, or form override the recreational immunity statute.
Well, what about the distinction between commercial slash industrial property and other types of property that upon which one could expect recreational activity to occur? I do not expect recreational activity to occur in a fenced-in yard next to a plant. I do expect recreational activity to, at least, for instance, in the Verdoliak case, even though it's, you know, it's a big woods, well, that's... Sure, you can commercially farm the woods, but on the other hand, there's a lot of recreational activity that can take place there, or at least can take place in a woods. So what about this commercial slash industrial versus recreational? Is that worth pursuing?
I think it is, Your Honor, because I think it goes to the heart of the matter of the purpose, the intended purpose of this statute. And that is that... landowners should not be subject to liability or to suit given recreational activities occurring on their land. And one of the reasons for this, the reason that the statute was originally enacted, is because we have expanding populations, we have decreasing green space, we have people that want to recreate, and what we have is a situation where landowners should be encouraged to open their land for recreational use or should not be punished for that having occurred on their premises, whether they know what's occurring or not.
Well, let me ask you a question that I'll hit Mr. Curtis with when he comes back. What if instead of these kids getting into the fence and then into these barrels, had instead got in through the fence, snuck in through a window that was open, a basement window or something, and played hide and seek down among the big machines or turbine engines or whatever that. And no question that they were playing, because I find that distinction in this case quite, I personally see great weakness in your case in the definition of recreational. But if, in fact, your opponent were to prevail, would that be covered under the recreational statute, recreational immunity? Kids sneaking in to the basement of the plant.
I think that would be considered an indoor activity, not an outdoor.
Oh, that's right. It's got to be outdoor
activity.
Thank you.
Right.
Well, let us suppose you've got a large area, and I've seen factories and commercial institutions that put in diamonds and even some small bleachers or even tennis courts for their employees. They don't intend that as an open thing. Big signs, no trespassing, big fences, right? Somebody comes through and uses the tennis court. Do you have any issue with that? That is, you think that's going to be immune?
Absolutely not. I think that is governed by the recreational immunity statute.
That's right.
So as an outdoor sport or game. And
even if the person's trespassing, and even though they're not supposed to be there.
Yes, Your
Honor. So they're play. So commercial and industrial is going to fall.
I think that's correct.
So now they take the next scene as it's just a large open area. Could be a parking lot when the employees are working. Now it's just one just huge area that could be great for baseball, football, soccer, you know. You can bring in your own basketball hoops, portable kinds. Immunity for the owner?
I think, yes, again, Your Honor. I think
so. This is going to turn on whether you view these children as engaging in recreational activity.
I believe that's correct. I think, Your Honor, under Linville and also under Siebert, the key is the nature of the activity, more
not
so
the property
than the nature of the land.
Now, one of the little problems here is the statute started out one way, encouraging opening, but then that didn't work, or at least there was a change of mind, and so it just, that's not, even the purpose is not irrelevant anymore.
I think that in looking again at the Linville test, as we look at the nature of the activity, that it is very important for the court to focus on what that objective test is, and that is the intrinsic nature of the activity, the purpose of the activity, and the consequence of the activity. If we look at those three objective tests in this fact situation, if we look at the intrinsic nature of what was occurring, is that, obviously that is not within the 28 enumerated activities under the statute, is it substantially similar to any one of those activities that are listed? Going through paper bales that have, in which tunnels have been created, lighting matches, causing a fire, that may be more criminal than it is anything else.
Excuse me, sometimes my mind trails the argument by a few minutes. Did I hear you concede to the chief that it is irrelevant that this accident occurred on commercial property, other than it's one of the factors to be taken into account, and that the only way you can succeed, the only way you can win this, is for us to find that this was not recreational activity?
Your Honor, I think what you stated is correct. Again, it is not irrelevant, but it is a factor to be considered, and that is, again, under the Linville test, I think everything has to be taken into consideration.
But it's not going to trigger it that it's commercial or industrial.
I don't believe that that is
the... That can't be a cutting line.
I don't believe that that is the test under Linville or under Siebert.
It's one of the things, and it may affect it, how recreational it is. That's why I moved you from that tennis court into just a large area, and now you've got an area that has materials on it, etc.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Could I ask you, counsel, if the boys had gone on the paper recycling property and had been playing tag and some injury had occurred because of perhaps something dangerous on the property, would that be a recreational activity?
I think much more arguably, Your Honor, than the facts of this case, and I think I would say yes. It is not, it is outdoor exercise, a sport or a game. With a sport or a game, I think there is an objective, there is a finish line, there is a score.
Hide and go seek.
There is an objective, there is, I don't know if there's a score, but there certainly is an objective, and it certainly is an outdoor exercise and activity. One of the things that, as I was thinking about this, in order to try to look at this from the standpoint of trying to factor out the child portion of this and looking at it from the standpoint of a reasonable and ordinary parent, if you look at the statute and the 28 activities that are enumerated thereunder, if I was the parent of a 10-year-old child and I said, okay, go ahead and do that. That's good recreation. Go ahead and do that. Go ahead and play tag over there on that lot. Go ahead and go fishing over there by that pond. But I, as a parent, would say that. But in this particular case, would I say, go ahead over through that hole in that fence to that land? And by the way, if you take matches, that's okay. And by the way, if you light those matches in the paper, that's okay.
Suppose there had been climbing on the bales, and one of the boys had fallen off and broken his neck. No matches now, but just climbing around the bales. Would that be covered?
I mean,
how would you treat that?
I think that is much more arguably within the confines of recreational immunity than the facts of this case.
So you're keying in on the fact that they had matches rather than that they probably were climbing. Obviously, I think that's the facts indicate that they were climbing. It seems to me difficult for us to reconcile that this case on the basis that because they lit the fire, because that's what caused the difficulty, that takes it out of any recreational activity.
I think in looking at the overall context of the activity, and I see my red light is on, that climbing might be substantially similar to the activities that are enumerated within the statute. But certainly lighting fires within paper bales and causing the death of an 11-year-old boy is not.
Thank you, Mr. Rogan. Mr. Cook?
If it pleases the court, my name is John Cook. I represent Minnesota Fire and Casualty. And I would like to start out by picking up on the last question, or one of the last questions. I think that if this case had not involved matches, I think that it would still not have fit within the definition of recreational activity. These children had gotten onto a dangerous commercial property. They were crawling underneath these loosely stacked bales of commercial property. These spaces were not made as forts. These spaces were left inside the piles of commercial property and by loosely stacking the bales. The children were crawling underneath these bales of materials.
Are you suggesting this is not outdoor activity?
No, I'm suggesting that it is not substantially similar to the 28 listed parts of the definition. Sievert makes it clear that we need to look at the definition in its whole, in its entirety. We cannot just look at the fact that it's an outdoor activity. We have to look at the enumerated examples of recreational activity, and then we have to look to the intent of the legislature, which is clearly stated as an intent that other activities that are substantially similar be brought within the definition.
Counsel, when you mentioned intent of the legislature, there's the Mosinee paper case, and there's a number of cases. I look at the Taylor case, which indicates some legislative intent. Wisconsin first adopted this. Such laws were enacted in response, citing 63 case. Such laws were enacted in response to the dramatic shrinkage of the public access to recreational land in an increasingly crowded world, blah, 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 blah. You're focusing on the activity. I'm not ready to give up the land, as some of the questions raised by Justice Babbage. Let me give you a clearly recreational activity. I'm a homeowner, nice suburban neighborhood. I built a nice, beautiful swimming pool. Maybe an ordinance, in fact, there would be an ordinance that requires the swimming pool be fenced. I don't fence it. Probably, arguably, negligence per se, violation of a safety statute, okay? 2 6-year-olds come, play. Now, unlike the Shannon case, where there's a question of what the intent of the 3-year-old was and wasn't a recreational activity, clearly this is going to be recreational. In fact, they bring some water ball to play. Is it your position that since it's recreational activity, that the homeowner is immune from any liability?
It's not my position, but unfortunately, I believe that it's the position of the legislature. That it's swimming is on the list.
How could the legislature if a homeowner in a suburban neighborhood has a swimming pool, violates the law regarding a fence, how could the legislature mean for this law to say the homeowner is immune? You may not, maybe you can't answer that question. You're not the legislature.
I can't defend this statute the way it's written, nor can I defend some of the cases that have suggested that if a child drowns at a beach and the lifeguards aren't on the job, that the owner or the operator of the beach is immune. But I believe that that is the law.
And what you're saying in these cases that's before us, that if the kid is playing tag, that you're going to be immune. But if the kid trespasses and engages in dangerous activity, you're liable.
Foolhardy activity of children, the typical type of dangerous, foolhardy play that children sometimes get into when they find access to certain kinds of properties.
And under this statute, the landowner is liable, or at least is subject to trial on liability.
That's
if the kid is playing and it gets hurt and even is killed, you're immune under the statute. What kind of sense does that make?
Again, I didn't write the legislation, but
okay.
I can tell
Less
you...
used.
I can tell you that the cases have again and again come down to a determination as to whether the activity involved is a recreational activity as defined by the statute. And the statute has a multifaceted definition, and Sievert says we have to look at all aspects of the definition, and if the activity is not a listed activity, we have to go to the substantially similar test that is directly in the legislative intent. That's a direct statement in the legislative intent, substantially similar. Question in this case is it a substantially similar activity when an 11-year-old trespasses on a dangerous commercial property and starts climbing underneath and playing underneath these loosely stacked bales of property and lighting fires? And is that like swimming and hunting and fishing and walking in the woods or playing football in a park? I believe that there is a substantially different character of that activity.
Counsel, what if these kids had come into this property and engaged in what is clearly recreational activity, throwing a ball, and just throwing a ball back and forth?
Okay. Football. Sure.
And then they see the stack, and they go into the stack, and then this tragedy occurs. Now, you're saying that we differentiate the playing ball. I'm not done with my question, but the playing ball from what had been recreational activity turns into non-recreational activity. Because you're saying going into the stack is non-recreational activity. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, now, the problem that I have with that is this. If you go onto the property and give the owner of the property immunity for recreational activity, but then the user suddenly decides to disengage from the recreational activity and engage in non-recreational activity, what then is the incentive for the owner of the property to allow the property to remain open if, in fact, his or her liability is grounded on the purely happenstance circumstance that recreational activity may become non-recreational activity? It seems to me that if I'm the owner of 40 acres in Portage County, and that's the case, I just say, hey, I can't take that chance. I'm shutting my land off.
I think there's two answers. There's two things I'd like to say in response to that one question. Number one is that the question that you have created is a different case. It's a much more difficult case because the cases that I have seen suggest that the entire activity has to be looked at as a whole. And if there's some momentary diversion to a different activity, it would be a fact situation as to whether the football was the primary activity that they were engaged in that day. However, as to the element of your question that has to do with a landowner potentially having two different sets of duties to two different sets of entrants, I'd like to make the point that, and it's dealt with in my written materials, I'd like to make the point that the legislature itself created this distinction. The legislature has created a statute that makes one set of legal duties to one set of entrants and one set of legal duties to another group of entrants based solely upon what they're doing. I mean, that's exactly what the legislature did. And if we take a scale of all possible activities that could be engaged in by children on the property, we can argue about where the line should be drawn, but the legislature has dictated that it be drawn somewhere and that there be fact cases on one side of the line and fact cases on another.
So if it's a social guest, your obligations are one thing. If it's a hunter on your land, your obligations are another. Or I shouldn't say obligations, your liability is different.
There is a different handling for social guests under the statute.
Okay, delivery person.
A delivery person may have been impliedly invited onto the premises.
So we have different, I'm just trying to give examples of different guests, different people on the land. The court keeps coming back to, if I'm going to not have immunity, I'm going to close my land. Doesn't matter whether you close your land.
I don't think so, not under this statute.
Not under this statute.
You can put up fences and signs and the decision on when the case goes to court is going to be based upon what the children were doing.
That's right. It has nothing to do with encouraging open land or not.
I don't believe so.
The only way you can get out from under the statute is maybe putting a whole bubble around it so you make it indoors.
That might work, yeah. I hadn't thought of that.
I'm not suggesting we do that.
Counsel, just looking at the statute itself, which you refer to when you talk about relaxation and pleasure, it is so broad, and that's the. I understand your argument in trying to say, well, this is so outrageous, or this goes beyond the line of. This is what we're doing. We're line drawing, but we have to. In order to do that, it has to be a quote sensible line. It has to be something that people would understand. What I have trouble with in this is that the other justices have asked, well, but they didn't have the matches, but they were just climbing. Well, that would be closer. But because they had, this is like because they had a match or they could have some other, say they brought a knife on the property and that's what caused the difficulty. Or let's say 11-year-old brought a gun and they did everything, but the gun went off, so that would... take it out of. It just seems very difficult to draw that line when the statute is so broad and talks about relaxation or pleasure.
I think that you have to go to the part of the definition that talks about substantially similar, and you have to keep asking whether the activity in question is substantially similar to the 28 listed activities.
That's not a definition, though. That's out of Seaver. Right.
Sievert did establish that the definition must be read broadly. The definition must be read as a whole, and that all three parts of the definition must be attempted to be coordinated and considered simultaneously.
But maybe Sievert's wrong.
Well.
Maybe Siebert's maybe that's, Siebert could be viewed as contextual, you know, you have to look at all, the whole context of it and interpret it. Maybe you have to look at each word and just do it textually.
I do know one thing, and as long as I'm still on yellow light, I do know one thing, and that is that if this court extends the immunity to dangerous child play on commercial properties that can be extremely dangerous, that there will be nothing left of the attractive nuisance doctrine in this state. I cannot imagine a situation where children of this age would be attracted onto a dangerous property.
Well, there is a malicious act exception or malicious failure to warn exception.
Yes, and I'd also like to point out that Section 7 of the statute, which deals with the interplay between attractive nuisance and the immunity statute, really only subordinates the attractive nuisance to the immunity statute only where the court finds that a recreational activity was being engaged in. So the suggestion there by the legislature is that they did not intend to completely abrogate the attractive nuisance doctrine.
Oh, sure they did. If there's a recreational activity going on.
If there is a recreational activity, absolutely.
And recreational activity is defined extremely broadly, and it is not tied to the nature of the property, but the nature of the activity that's going on.
Correct. And the cases, Linville and Siebert, have made it clear that the test for whether we have a recreational activity is essentially an objective one, and the court must consider objective factors about the activity as well as the subjective statements of intent by the actors. And I have a red light.
Cook, I have another question. Mr. Rohde is suing the paper recycling company for negligence. The paper recycling company lost all its property, and apparently you were suing to get back money that was paid to your particular client, the lessor. Is that correct?
Our client owned the property.
It seems to me that paper recycling is being hit pretty hard here. I mean, they lost their business, they're being sued from both sides. Maybe that's exactly what the legislature wanted to avoid. How do you respond to that?
I don't believe that the legislature intended to create immunity for the owner of a commercial property where the activities engaged in by the entrants were not traditional recreational activity. I didn't understand the question. I'm sorry, Matt, but the legislature appears to have made all of our decisions about all of these cases conditioned upon a finding of a recreational activity as defined by the statute. And maybe I don't know if I'm answering your question or not. I apologize.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Mr. Curtis, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Justice.
I have a question right away. One of these kids was adjudicated delinquent for negligent handling of burning materials. Is that right?
That's correct.
And was that the kid who brought the matches?
I believe that's accurate.
Okay. And that's tantamount to the finding that he was engaged in criminal activity.
I'm not so sure of that, Justice. It was a juvenile charge, and it was a charge based on negligence. There are many provisions that the legislature has seen fit to involve some type of a technical criminal sanction where the conduct is merely negligent.
That's criminal negligence. And if committed by an adult, would be considered a crime.
I think that's true.
Okay. Now, does that change the analysis at all here, the nature of the activity? If it's criminal in nature, does that make it non-recreational?
I don't think that it should in any way. Again, I think that the element of the criminal charge was based on negligence. It was negligent handling of burning materials, I think, was the specific charge.
Go ahead.
I think it takes it back to some of the questions that have been posed by the court as to, well, what is the nature of this play, and if it becomes dangerous, should that make a difference in the court's analysis and a conclusion of whether it amounts to recreation? I think that what we have is a situation where, at the trial court level, one circuit judge focused on the play with matches, or perhaps the criminal charge, Justice, that you inquire about, and saying, I just don't think that could be recreation. The other circuit judge took a broader view of the overall activity and said, I'm not going to focus on just what happened at the time of the accident. I'm going to look at the overall activity. And I think the Court of Appeals adopted that approach in this case, too, in saying, well, if it's recreational, we agree that if it becomes dangerous, it doesn't change it into something different.
Counsel, that's what I want to talk about, because I hear a voice, maybe unknown to other boys, brought matches. I talked about someone bringing a knife or a gun, and say they went up on the property and engaged in whatever activity they engaged in here, but certainly, because it was criminal activity, one of the boys shot the other boy, or had the gun and didn't intend to shoot him, but when they were sliding down the bales, it went off, or as I used the knife example. Why wouldn't that be a good for line drawing here, and we're having difficulty, and you can tell that by the questions of the court, to use that, because that would be an area that would be fairly clearly understood.
Well, I mean, I acknowledge that if all things being the same, but one of the boys brought along a knife and someone got cut as opposed to someone getting burned, I really don't think that changed anything other than that the court would need a factual analysis of the circumstances of the knife and the motivation for bringing it along and how the accident happened. I think that all of that would be...
What was the motivation for bringing the matches along? What if he brought matches and some gasoline along? Would that show a greater intent than just bringing the matches?
Well, I think it could, if the purpose of bringing gasoline along was to throw Molotov cocktails. You know, perhaps the court would feel that that is not going to need a level of recreation. And I think that it's fine, and I understand that the court is struggling with some of these distinctions, and that we're all prone to look at different hypothetical situations. And I think that's fine for purposes of analysis and is the court's role. But I do think we have to come back to this case. And when we look at this case, the fact that the play became dangerous, I don't think is sufficient to change anything. To hold that recreational play would fall outside of the statutory definition if it became dangerous, such as with the play with matches, would place an impossible burden on the property owner, because the statute says that from the outset the owner has no duty and cannot be liable. And if suddenly a change in the dangerous nature of the play imparts a duty on the property owner, we defeat the entire purpose of the law. We make it incumbent on the property owner to monitor the activities of the recreational user, to make sure it doesn't get to the level of danger that might take it outside of the definition of recreation. And I think we've defeated the legislative purpose at that point.
Are you saying that if the initial foray onto the land is for purposes of recreational activity, that can never change?
Well, not never change, Justice, but we have a number of examples.
It sounds like it, because you're saying that unless it can never change, there's always going to be some kind of duty for the landowner to monitor, and there will be then a disincentive to open up the land.
Well, I think that the, you know, never change is probably going too far, but we have a number of case examples. Hall versus Turtle Lake, where the recreational attendant at the fair, the nature of his activity didn't change by his, quote, momentary diversion to go to the restroom where the accident occurred. The court had no trouble with finding that immunity applied. In the Sauer versus Reliance case, we've got a plaintiff walking down the river to go fishing and trying to make the distinction that he wasn't yet fishing and therefore it's not recreational. The court would have none of it. We have the Schultz case where a recreational attendant at a fair sought to assist by capturing a runaway steer and was hurt. And again, I think he had a pretty good argument that at the time he went to capture a runaway steer, it wasn't a lot of fun and relaxation and pleasure. But the court refused to make a hair-splitting analysis, but rather looked to the overall nature of the activity in deciding that it was recreational.
Chief Justice Bradley, I want to look at the words of the statute, and I want to look at the definition of recreational activity sub G. It seems to me that when I compare the first sentence with the second sentence, the statute is ambiguous. And it's ambiguous to me because I can think of a myriad of outdoor activities that are done for relaxation and pleasure that would clearly come within the plain words of the definition. And you get to the listing. But those very same activities, outdoor activities done for pleasure or recreation, that clearly come within the definition, seem inconsistent with the second part of the statute, that is, the 28 examples. There's nothing in the words of this statute that say, oh, the examples are going to trump the definition. In fact, generally, it's different. I mean, generally, you have a definition, which is the overriding, you know, the heavyweight. And here, you have some examples which include. But the overarching umbrella is the definition. Yet, many examples of outdoor activity done for pleasure and done for relaxation, which come within the clear words of the definition, are inconsistent with the examples. What do you do? I mean, isn't that an ambiguity?
Justice, respectfully, I don't think it's an ambiguity. I think that what it represents, as the legislature said in its statement of intent, in 1983,
I read that, and it seems to me the statement of intent says the same thing. It says we give the 28 examples, but it also says that there's a, clear. What example are you thinking of? Sunbathing? What example are you thinking of?
Well, I'm thinking of smoking.
Or what about sunbathing?
You know, I mean, without offending anyone, I'm thinking of someone who has sexual intercourse outside. Isn't that come within the clear definition of the first sentence?
Of the first sentence,
absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. Who in their wildest dreams? Well, maybe I shouldn't say that. Because dreaming could be recreational activity.
Right. Well, Justice, if I can, I think that...
I'm a bit serious, though. How do I know, since there's nothing in the words of the statute that say, oh, the examples are going to trump the definition. In fact, quite the contrary, it says, here's the definition, and it includes the following, which means, but is not, which includes the following. Okay, I want to stay with the words. So I don't know. It meets the definition, but it doesn't meet the examples, which are, as I interpret, not exhaustive.
Well, I think that it's not an issue of ambiguity, but rather one of difficulty of application of a lengthy deposition to particular facts. I think that the legislature, in citing 28 specific activities, had in mind many of the cases that are on the books in Wisconsin. Climbing towers, it's an attractive nuisance case. Harvesting the products of nature, that's a spin-off of the former phrase of the berry-picking statute. What they sought to do was to expand the horizons in 1983 and to make a very broad definition, recognizing that they could not specify everything that would be a fit. And I think that the proper method of analysis, based on this court's decision in Siebert, and again, I would cite to the Lasky case of the Court of Appeals at 582 Northwest 2nd 64, which interpreted the Siebert approach, is qualifying under the first broad definition, smoking, it's not enough. You have to go beyond, and if you meet the third prong of the deposition, you're there, and it's recreation. Short of that, you make a comparison to the 28 specifically listed activities, and beyond that, you make a comparison of similarity to what the legislature had in mind on a broad level basis in order to provide what this court has recognized is the certainty that a true immunity statute applies, the only way to make a true encouragement of property owners to open their land.
Thank you, Mr. Curtis. Thank you, Mr. Rohde and Mr. Cook. That concludes our argument in 99-0327. The students and anyone else who wishes will remain here to talk with Justice Wilcox. We are in recess until Tuesday, December 12th at 9:30. We'll go back to conference. We'll go back to conference in about 20 minutes.